The point here is that if we look at the two sessions, contrary to Western characterizations of rubber stamp parliament, what we see is the example of effective governance. What we see is a government working together to solve problems that are not only beneficial to China, but are beneficial to the whole world.
Welcome to The Bridge, fun conversations on culture, life, and everything in between.
Find us where you get your podcasts. If you like the show, then consider pushing the like button or giving us 5 stars. Suggestions, comments, anything you would like to share, email us at welovethebridge@gmail.com. We love The Bridge. Oh,
yeah. Oh, yeah. Welcome to The Bridge. China's annual two sessions is imminent and forms the cornerstone of China's whole process people's democracy. Today with us to help us better understand is American professor Joseph Gregory Mahoney, professor of politics and international relations at East China Normal University and a senior research fellow for the Institute for the Development of Socialism with Chinese Characteristics at Southeast University. Welcome back to The Bridge, Professor Mahoney.
Thank you, Jason. How are you doing?
I'm really well. You know, I have some issues with my cat, but other than that, everything's going well. How are you?
I'm surviving the Year of the Dragon. It was a very long break with the two kids here in the household. We managed to avoid any conflict or bloodshed. Actually, it was a restful time. I probably should have gotten more work done than I did, but it's also nice to take a break every once in a while.
You know, I read a lot of the content that you put out, and you say that you should get more work done. That makes me feel terrible because you produce an article like every other day, it seems like. So I think that you work more than most people. You're quite prolific.
Well, that's very kind of you. I think, you know, part of the problem, of course, is that you start trying to run with the big dogs, and there are people who are a lot more productive than me. And I try to, you know, measure my own output in terms of what they do without dropping too far into the second or third tier. So anyway, yeah. So let's talk about the two sessions.
Absolutely. In an article you wrote for CGTN, The Theory and Practice of Chinese Democracy, you describe thumbnail explanations of Chinese people's democracy, one being, quote, processes that culminate in the various outcomes of the masses that the masses seek, including national development, poverty alleviation, access to healthcare and education, improved sovereignty, security, and so on. Would you say that China's outcomes have met the needs of the people? And could you provide a couple of examples?
Well, you know, I think we're all quite familiar at this point with the litany of achievements associated with the People's Republic of China since liberation and the establishment of the PRC in 1949. The first among these, of course, being the fact that it was able to find a political solution for the crisis of Chinese modernity, a crisis that was brought to China by the European powers, starting primarily with the Opium Wars in the early part of the 1800s. And then, you know, of course, accelerating with war with Japan in 1895, and then the various other semi-colonial experiences that China had with Japan, as well as Western countries that, as we know, not only imperiled China as an independent nation, not only subjugated large parts of China under colonial rule, it also killed multitudes, the most famous example being the Nanjing Massacre. So on the one hand, China, the CPC, as the Revolutionary Party, was able to effectively create a solution to this crisis, one that would allow China to reestablish sovereignty and to begin to build the necessary security for national rejuvenation. That's sort of the threshold, and I think that's something that everyone was seeking. But whether or not they were committed to the CPC in the beginning, I think all Chinese were wanting that type of outcome. And in fact, the CPC was able to deliver that. Subsequently, of course, we have government and the party pressing forward with various development schemes. Some of these worked very, very well. Some of them ran into some incredible challenges. But ultimately, the system was self-correcting. And what we know is throughout the period of New China, we have seen, by some counts, 700, other counts, 800 million people lifted out of poverty, the elimination of extreme poverty, the establishment of a Shao Kung society. This is a concept consistent with old Confucian thought, but also Deng Xiaoping theory within the context of Chinese Marxism. of creating a moderately prosperous society. In this case, we can imagine that China is, as a socialist country, avoiding the term middle-class society, and which we can understand as constituting at this point more than 400 million middle-income earners. Since the new era associated with Xi Jinping, we've seen incredible steps taken to get corruption under control, to reform government institutions, and to significantly improve governance. Of course, we can see the outcome of this being that China has been able to withstand the U.S. Trade war and what Xi Jinping himself has characterized as the American technology blockade. But it was also the case that this improved governance allowed China to address other emergent concerns. For example, China is the leading country addressing climate change. It is the leading innovator in green development and green transitions. You live in Beijing. You can see, depending on how long you've lived there, you can see how substantially the government has cleaned up the air quality. We've seen the same thing in Shanghai and many other cities across China. There have been dramatic improvements in water quality and the waterways. One of them outside my window here, Suzhou Creek. When I came here, it was still effectively a large urban sewer. Now it's returned to a healthy, productive river. There's fish, there's water birds. People are fishing on the side of the river that have been turned into parklands running throughout the city. This, you know, tremendous increase in green spaces in tandem with the Suzhou Creek Rehabilitation Project. So all of these things are very tangible results, economically, quality of life, improved governance. Final one, of course, is China's unparalleled response to the pandemic. This remains something that none of us really want to recall because, you know, it required sacrifices from everyone in order to make that work. But the fact of the matter is China did exceed, as a large country, did exceed expected capacities. Public health practice did not think that China would be able to do what it did. But it did so, in this case, putting people over profits and emphasizing human well-being in ways that correspond with socialistic values, like protecting the most vulnerable people, the elderly, the people who are weaker or less advantaged, who have less access to adequate health care, as some developing parts of China. So all of these are examples of Chinese democracy that have improved the security, well-being, and quality of life of the Chinese people, raising it out of a century of humiliation and returning it to the forefront of nations.
Wow, that's quite a list, actually.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to The Bridge.
Well, you've also described the instrumental practices of direct elections at the grassroots level, combined with the indirect democracy of successfully higher forms of representation, the voting that still occurs in higher level state and party apparatuses, including the NPC and others. In your assessment, what is the role of two sessions?
Well, you know, I think the main problem is that most people, when they look at the NPC or the CPPCC from the outside, they try to judge it relative to, say, the U.S. Congress or the British Parliament or other types of legislatures or political systems. And in fact, you know, clearly the Chinese system works differently. But the key point is that it does work to achieve democratic outcomes. And we've explained already what some of these democratic outcomes are. But understanding that the two sessions from their inception have been instrumental in helping to achieve these outcomes. It's part of a systemic approach to pulling the nation together, uniting the various regions, ethnic groups, social classes into a common objective of national rejuvenation. In the case of the CPPCC, what we have is a very large organization that draws people from all walks of life, be they different ethnic groups, social groups, industrial groups, academics, celebrities, so forth and so on, who are interested in contributing to the function of governance, who have some expertise or perspectives that are valuable and can enrich policymaking. And these people come to Beijing and constitute the CPPCC as one of the two sessions through which they can make proposals to the NPC, but they can also respond to inquiries or proposals from the NPC. Now, they provide an advisory role. They don't provide the sort of role that you would expect, say, from a an upper chamber like the Senate or the House of Lords, the Senate in the U.S. case or the House of Lords in the British case. They're there to provide advice and consultation just to augment the democratic representation of the system as a whole, specifically the NPC. Whereas the NPC is tasked with the key functions of government. For example, the premier gives his annual work report there. And if you follow that carefully, one of the things you'll see is that the premier will deliver a speech, and then there may be some concerns or objections or requests for changes or additions to the speech from the delegates. And what we'll see is that the final work report can change. So it's given as a speech, and then there's some process that reviews it in the Congress, and then the premier has to respond to the congressional concerns and amend the report to match what they think the proper outcome should be. There are also other reports from key institutions, Supreme Court, for example, all the other major government ministries and organs. And then what we see, of course, are budget reviews from the central government, but also the provincial levels and the major cities under the central government. This is an opportunity also to examine economic and development plans from the previous year, but also for the coming year. So it's a big opportunity to review the work, to think about the work to come, and for people to come into broad agreement about what's happened and what's going to happen so that everyone can then work together on the same page to achieve outcomes like we've seen in terms of eliminating extreme poverty or lifting 800 million people out of poverty or creating a Chiao Kung society.
You've also written, and I think this is more of an international kind of question, that two sessions, Beijing's beacon of unity and governance in a world gone mad. So in what way do you see China providing a beacon of unity in this very complicated world that we live in?
Well, let's talk about a world gone mad first. I don't remember when I published that, but you know, we could find many points in the last 5 or 6 years to demonstrate sort of a global madness in effect, whether it's associated with what's happening in Gaza now or what continues to linger in the conflict in Ukraine, or Europe buckling under U.S. pressure in the incredible, awful expansion of NATO, the return to a Cold War logic, the expansion of expansion of a NATO-like organization in Asia, AUKUS directed against China, while these various countries, chief among them the United States, are propagating that their political system, that their democracy is the best form, despite experiencing themselves extreme dysfunction in their governance. We can point, for example, to the U.S. today, barreling towards a presidential election with two candidates that both may lead the country to further ruin, but certainly few people in the country are really excited about these two candidates running, except those who have in some way lost connection to reality and have just committed themselves to either Trump or Biden, not so much as an act of love, but as an act of hatred towards the other. This is extreme polarization. It's extreme politicization. And I think, you know, if you talk to most people in the United States, they know that their society is in danger. They know that the middle class has been hollowed out, a process that began in the 1980s. They know that they have been misled by their government in terms of a consistent trend in military misadventures that enriched certain firms and depleted the public well-being in terms of incredible deficit spending through the years. They know that corporations have not had the best interest of the nation in mind, that they have always looked to exploit opportunities without any significant regard for the public well-being. And this, you know, includes a lot of companies that, of course, did business in China, that came to China and exploited Chinese labor and exploited what were then relatively lax laws for Chinese environmental protections in order to fill shops in the United States with cheap products. And, you know, we've moved past that era now, and American workers are finding that they are struggling to compete in a world where other countries like China have fared better. And the politicians are saying, well, look, China took advantage of you. It's nonsense, but, you know, it's what sells. In the meantime, you know, what really happened, of course, is that you have American farmers pharmaceutical companies that exploited workers in the United States after the U.S. instigated global financial crisis in 2008, which, you know, placed a very heavy toll on my generation. A lot of my generation lost their jobs, lost their homes, lost their families. When you lose your job, you lose your health insurance. People then became depressed or started self-medicating because of a lack of healthcare access. Many of them were already addicted to pain medication, given gross mismanagement of their healthcare to begin with. And then they start getting involved in the opioid crisis, or then later the fentanyl crisis. And again, you know, this is being blamed on China in some way. So this is the problem in the U.S. is, I think, the textbook example, but we can see similar issues in South Korea, tremendous polarization. We can see it in Taiwan, Australia, the U.K., Germany, France, around the world. And I'm not picking on any one country, and I certainly have no animosity to anyone, but these are the places that are being held up as the exemplars of democracy and social progress and human liberation and human rights. And yet they're in a state of disarray, and they're barreling in some sense towards new conflicts and a new Cold War and trying to blame China for it. And the point here is that if we look at the two sessions, contrary to Western characterizations of rubber stamp parliament, what we see is the example of effective governance. What we see is a government working together to solve problems that are not only beneficial to China, but are beneficial to the whole world. And we can point, again, to examples here. One, obviously, is the example of the Belt Road Initiative, which has pushed somewhere in the range of $1 trillion in investment into especially the global South over the past decade. And by most sober analyses, is creating tremendous opportunities for real economic growth in places that were long neglected. And secondarily, again, you know, we go back to China's response to the pandemic. In 2020, China saved the world economy. China was able to pull itself together and restart production. And it was China that saved the world in 2020, not only providing the world with the products it needed to survive the disease, but also to keep economic development going. And then, of course, China held the line as long as it could, and thereby kept roughly 20% of the world's population out of the broader human reservoir that was producing hundreds of different mutations and varieties of COVID. If China hadn't done that, then the COVID experience globally would have been much worse, not only in terms of morbidity and mortality in China itself, but that would have had an accelerating effect on the pandemic globally. So these are tremendous public goods, including, of course, the vaccines that China developed and offered to the world during that period. These are tremendous public goods that this system has produced that are improving the well-being of people, especially people in times of dire need. So again, it's strange, and I would say a sign of madness, that this would be characterized as something other than a positive contribution to human development.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to The Bridge.
The West, and especially the United States, often point to minorities in China and expresses concern for their well-being, although my own opinion is that is misplaced. But the two sessions have a way of including, as you mentioned earlier, a broad range of people. Before I get started, let's go back to the United States, for example. If we look at Congress, you know, both houses, you see a lot of people who are trained lawyers, a lot of people who are trained public speakers, but you see very few plumbers, for example. So, or, you know, a broad representation of variety of minority groups. Could you talk a little bit about how Two Sessions is inclusive to a great degree, a variety of different people from different walks of life?
Well, I think I mentioned previously that the CPPCC does intentionally seek a broad spectrum of diversity that might otherwise be neglected in the more politically oriented system of the NPC, which is predominantly made up of politicians or people who have designated delegates to the NPC, like the military, for example. But that said, there are quite a number of people who are delegates to the NPC who are from different ethnic groups, who do represent different regions, autonomous groups. And these people are generally recognized not only in terms of their general position as a delegate, but also the fact that they are representing the groups that they originate from. In the case of the CPPCC, I think it's certainly a lot more open. In this case, you do have people, as I've said, coming from different industries. You can have sports figures. I know some professors who are members. I know some business leaders who are members. I'm not going to name names, but I had lunch with a woman here in Shanghai who works for one of the major global accounting firms who's a member of the CPPCC. And so she is a high-level executive in that accounting firm. She understands very well the global business climate. She has access to a lot of data, a lot of information. Her firm produces a lot of reports on global health and Chinese economic health. And so she goes to the two sessions. And when she goes there, she not only brings her knowledge and expertise, but she also listens and hears what else is being said and done by other participants, but also from the government itself. And this, she's not only able to provide information, but also to gather information, which in turn will help her improve her work and the work that or people that she represents or the industry that she represents, and certainly the city that she represents. And we can find this across, again, this broad spectrum of society, whether it's sports figures or professors or artists, filmmakers. Every year, there's a huge list of people who are included in the process and who have opportunities to learn and contribute their expertise. And this, again, provides an incredible source of information sharing. But, you know, it's not just this. China has also put in place online means for people to submit requests for the government. And these can not only provide sort of an online democratic function, that are now being used to supplement and extend the more formal practices associated with the CPPCC as well as the NPC.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to The Bridge.
Yeah, I have a book about China's whole people process democracy, and in it also talks about a lot of the elected NPC members have office hours that the community can come and visit them and, you know, complain actually and say, hey, these are the things that I want to be addressed in the future. And so they can take that into under advisement and consider a more broad way of including their local communities. I wanted to ask you, and you said this might be challenging because there wasn't a plenary, but what aspects of the two sessions and their proposals do you think foreign media are especially interested in? You know, not just what Chinese people see two sessions may need to focus on, but what do you think people abroad, maybe businesses, are looking at two sessions?
I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind here is that the two sessions are, so, you know, we have a National Party Congress, and this begins a five-year cycle. And then each year in that five-year cycle, there is a theme, an overarching theme for one of the two sessions. So this year, we are in the five-year cycle of the year that focuses on economic reforms. And so this would indicate, if we stick with this tradition, then this would indicate that this year is a year that we would expect some significant policymaking associated with economic reforms. Now, the issue here is, as you noted, plenary wasn't held at the end of the year, of last year. Typically, the party holds those, and there are reports that come out of the plenary. And these reports foreshadow, in some respects, what we might be seeing in terms of possible policymaking during the two sessions. We didn't have that plenary, but we did have a major economic work conference at the end of the year in late December that did give us some ideas about what to expect. And in this sense, I think what we can intuit, at least from that meeting, is that the government will continue to try to emphasize growth. In other words, that this is not the time to aggressively try to restructure the economy or to aggressively solve some issues. In other words, you know, sometimes when you want to restructure or aggressively address some issues in your economy, it's costly. And you have to be in a position where you can afford that type of maneuver. And given the challenges related to emerging from COVID, this post-COVID economic recovery, which by most indications, we've seen some stabilization as of late 2023, but still there are a lot of pressures that some groups of people are facing. And I think everyone would be a lot happier if the recovery was moving quicker. And at the same time, I think everyone is concerned that based on a number of projections from leading analysts, analysts, there's a global risk of recession this year in terms of anticipated global growth rates and global inflation rates. So with all of this in mind, what we see coming out of that work conference is the recognition that the government needs to try to emphasize growth and deal with problems on a case-by-case basis and to not destroy something before you've created an effective and proven new solution. So it's going to be some muddling through. Certainly, some things are already underway, like corrections associated with the property market. That's moving along in fits and spurts, but it's being managed. And everyone I speak with who has an intelligent perspective on it understands that it's being managed. It's not something that is beautiful to watch, in a, as one might watch an elegant ballet, but nevertheless, it's being effectively managed. So what we anticipate, what most people anticipate, given the tradition of focusing on the economy and given what we saw from this economic work conference at the end of last year, is that we'll see some economic policymaking that on the one hand will try to promote growth, but also try to hold off on major structural reforms. There is clearly talk about stimulating domestic consumption. This has always been a target and it's never been achieved the way the government has hoped or envisioned. Maybe we'll see a breakthrough this year, but you know, it's a very delicate balance now. The government is still trying to rely on the market as much as possible. It understands that if it intervenes too heavily, that things can quickly tumble out of control and that it'll have a bigger mess to clean up. So it's trying to find the right mix of subsidies and supports and stimulus packages that will contribute to real growth, that won't just see a short-term bounce and the stock market that people can then exploit for short-term gains. These are the sorts of things that they're thinking about and trying to craft policies for. And this is what people will be looking at. Because whether you like China or not, China is the major trading partner of most countries in the world. And whatever negative outcomes that we see with the Chinese economy, it will have an impact on global economic well-being. So this is the first thing that people will be paying attention to. And then secondarily, I think there are other issues like whether or not we'll see a new foreign minister named, whether or not we will see some concrete results with, in terms of what is called high-level opening up in certain key sectors like healthcare access, pharmaceuticals, and other areas. So these are other things that people will be looking for.
Wow. You know, I was talking to David Ferguson, and he mentioned the outcomes are what China's whole process, people's democracy, is particularly good at. Whatever we think of the system, the outcomes are something that are very tangible in China. And you wrote an article, The Principles of Chinese Democracy, in which you wrote, "All too often when liberal Democrats discuss democracy, they conflate mechanisms with principles." Could you elaborate on what you think about this?
Yeah, the idea here is that in the United States, again, as an American, I'll pick on the U.S., not again because I have some anger towards my country, but I, in fact, have deep love and concern for the well-being of the American people, who include my family. But one of the things that we see is that the U.S. tends to idealize certain concepts, for example, justice, democracy, human rights, and then idealize mechanisms that, on paper at least, should be able to manifest those ideals in practice. And so then, you know, we create this system of democracy. Now, there's two sides to this discussion. On the one hand, it should be clear that the founders of the United States, the framers of the Constitution, wanted democracy, but they also wanted to limit it. This is why they created this system of checks and balances and gave, of course, a tremendous amount of power to the House of Representatives, which is, on the one hand, the most democratic, supposed to be the most democratic mechanism of U.S. government, but then put limits on this in terms of making sure that the House of Representatives had to be seconded in legislation by the Senate, and then that that legislation, except in rare cases, would have to be endorsed by the president. So they create a system of democracy that on paper is, on the one hand, trying to realize democracy, but on the other hand, is trying to make sure that democracy doesn't go too far. Now, whether or not they were on the right track or not, we know, of course, that the founders did not originally include women or minorities and their idea of citizenship or democracy or voting rights. And certainly, you know, they ended up creating a system that would empower a U.S. president to act, as the famous American historian Arthur Schlesinger remarked, as an imperial president, that the president is empowered with such tremendous authority in terms of foreign policy that he can basically wage war on whoever he wants. And where is the democracy in that? Nevertheless, the problem, of course, is that today, one of the key failures of the U.S. democratic system is in Congress, and most especially the House of Representatives. And we've seen this play out in the last couple of years, especially with the Republicans blowing up their own Speaker of the House and then struggling to elect a replacement and then having to resort to placating a radical minority group that doesn't represent the majority of the American people. And what we also see is that even when Congress has been able to elect its leaders and to function, they haven't been able to consistently pass legislation that serves the greater good, and certainly have been unable to reform the system in ways that would make it more effective in this era. So as a result, what we've seen is power shifting to the president and to the court system, the president being compelled by these circumstances to rule by executive order, as opposed to Congress legislating. And in the absence of effective legislation, the courts, including the Supreme Court, having to make rulings that are then being taken as laws. The court is creating case law that is then functioning as, in effect, the legislation that Congress is unable to produce itself. So what we see then is that the democratic aspect of government has failed substantially. And instead, those parts of government that are the least democratic are the ones that are, in fact, ruling now, and ruling in ways that are making most Americans unhappy, as we consistently see in terms of their satisfaction with the president or the court or the Congress. And that's just looking at the federal level. I won't discuss the state level and all the various concerns there. So the problem is, you know, they created what in their mind, what most Americans, I think most Americans still think that there's something rather beautiful and marvelous about the system, about the mechanism, and that it somehow is the embodiment of the principle. And yet it's unable to deliver real democratic outcomes or results or progress for the people. So that's what I mean when I say they conflate mechanisms with principles.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to The Bridge.
You've also discussed how Western writers, quote, erroneously equate personal property in opposition to public property. And I'm not sure I entirely understand, but how is democracy a farce in nations in which 1 or 10% control the property or means of production? Did I get that wrong?
I don't remember the direct quote. It's possible that, as you know, I write too much and sometimes I write inelegantly. But what I assume that I was trying to, the point I was trying to make in that article is that one of the problems, and this is, you know, a point that I teach in the Marxism seminar that I teach here at the university, is that in the West, we make two general mistakes to note here. The first is people have this ahistorical understanding of capitalism. In other words, they think that capitalism is something that has always existed and that it is an economic system that best fits human nature. And so, you know, they think, okay, well, it existed during the feudal period, it existed during the Roman Empire, it existed, so forth and so on. And that's not true. Capitalism has its seeds in the 1500s. It becomes something that we would recognize today as capitalism by the 1700s, and here we are. So it's not something that's been with us forever. It's something that emerged in a specific period of time. And likewise, it emerged in tandem with a new concept of what it meant to be human, which is a whole different lecture that I don't think would your listeners should tolerate from me at this moment. But the second mistake that people make is, and this is particularly true, I think, in the U.S., is that they mistake personal property with private property. And so, for example, my phone is my personal property, and my jacket is my personal property. Perhaps I own a home. I don't. I'm a professor in Shanghai, a foreign professor in Shanghai. I don't have enough money to buy property in Shanghai. But nevertheless, if I did, it would still be my personal property as much as I would be living in it, raising my children in it. Private property, however, is a right that, again, starts to emerge in the 1500s. We see it starting to emerge with Henry VIII, where certain people are granted the right to own the means of production. In other words, to accumulate, hold, and utilize what we would recognize today as finance capital, and to use that capital to organize and finance economic activity. For example, start a factory, hire workers, pay wages, and own what is produced, and have the right to then sell that and then to own the proceeds. So that's private property, right? So a lot of times when people are talking about private property, you have a lot of workers in the United States, a lot of people who certainly don't own the means of production, and yet they misunderstand their personal property as private property, and then they think that they have something in common with someone like Donald Trump, who absolutely conflates personal and private property, right? And this is very important for the effective mythologies of capitalism, and certainly capitalism in the United States, that you too can get rich. You can get lucky, or you can work hard, or you can be innovative, whatever it is, but you have a real opportunity to become rich. And even if you don't become rich, you have the opportunity to become moderately well off or middle class or better than you were. And you don't want anyone taking that right away from you, whether it's a fantasy or to some extent a reality. So people then become sort of ideologically committed to this idea of protecting private property by equating it as the desire to accumulate and hold personal property. So this is where I was going with that comment.
Wow. Yeah, I guess I didn't quite understand the answer. And now that I do, that is really quite brilliant. I'm going to actually take that out and send it to some people I know. All right. So I recently was watching Li Jingjing. She's a CGTN reporter. She was in Xinjiang, and she was attending the Xinjiang People's Congress and the local regional two session in Urumqi. So I was wondering, for those of us who don't understand China's political system, do all of the different municipalities and regions of China have their own two sessions? And what is the relationship to the national two sessions?
Well, in fact, several years ago, I attended the Shanghai Consultative Conference, and I was invited to attend as a foreign professor working for East China Normal University. We also had some foreign students who were invited to attend. And it was an outreach effort being made by the local government to show people who were here how government was working and how they could connect to it themselves. And we were not allowed to participate formally in the meeting, but we were allowed to see how the meetings worked. We were in the gallery, and we were aware of who the representatives were there, who the delegates were, and how we could get in touch with them and communicate our own issues or concerns or questions if we had any. So to answer your question in part, there are these local structures who will then deliberate local concerns. They will solicit information. They will take information and channel it up the line to Beijing. And we have local people who are elected to these sessions. We have elections on campus. And I'm not allowed to vote because I'm not a Chinese citizen, but I see normally what happens is the voting will take over the cafeteria, one of the big cafeterias for the day. And the whole day, people will be coming in to vote. And they'll be told who the candidates are and what their choices are and so forth and so on. So that's something that we see at the local level. But I think one of the things is, I don't want to get too theoretical here, but if you understand dialectics, then what you understand is that the government devolves some power to. So what the central government does is it will come up with an overarching policy. And this policy may be targeted at leading cities, or it may be targeted at the countryside, or it may be targeted at a specific region. It doesn't necessarily have to be a single policy for the whole country. And then this policy will be generally expressed in terms of guidance. So then that guidance is then sent to the local level, and then the local level has to figure out, okay, how can we implement that guidance in a way that represents the democratic needs of the people, but also how can we do it in ways that will actually achieve productive outcomes that will actually improve the situation. And so in this case, you may have, for example, a policy that's being crafted in Shanghai to try to contribute to a national level goal that is different in terms of how it's being actualized relative to the a related effort in Wuhan or Beijing or Nanjing or some other place. So on the one hand, you know, it is a system for pushing information and democratic desires up the chain, for pushing people and representatives up the chain, and then for things coming back down, and then people trying to figure out how to best implement this collective decision making in a way that fits the local needs. So figure out what local people want and need, figure out how that fits into the national plan and agenda, craft guidance, provide necessary support, and then try to empower the local area to achieve the outcome.
I really like interviewing you because the interview is like being in a classroom. You're a very good teacher. You are able to express these ideas in a way that a student can understand. So I think all of our listeners will be very appreciative of what you have been able to teach us about China's whole process, people's democracy. That's all the time we have. I want to thank you so much on behalf of myself and our listeners for everything that you've taught me and our listeners as well. Thank you for your time, Dr. Joseph Gregory Mahoney.
Thank you, Jason. Always a pleasure to join you.